everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror. We are podcasting from the hard and snowy and merry and Christmassy and Hanukkah-y halls today. And it is our Christmas episode. It is 2 years of Faculty of Horror goodness. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you for sticking with us. And we are so happy to get to spend part of the holidays in your ears.
It's true. Our holiday episode is also our anniversary episode. It's hard to believe it's been 2 whole years. Thank you for listening and for your wonderful feedback. It means the world to us.
And I think when you're close with people, whether they are friends or it's, you know, a podcast or a TV show or movies that you love, I always get really excited about the holiday time, because I think as you get older, it becomes less of a time of gift giving, even though we love gifts, and it becomes more a time of just trying to spend quality time together and making that extra effort to see people you care about and maybe you don't get to see all the time throughout the year and going to parties. And that's what I really love about this time of year.
So speaking of the season of giving and our wonderful, wonderful listeners who mean the world to us, we were given a beautiful gift basket this holiday from one of our very special listeners.
Demon Owen Garth. He has been a listener right off the bat, and he gifted us this really lovely gift basket full of goodies and treats and really fun stuff that Andrew and I will get to go to the gym for a while for. And he's also the fellow behind 2 of the most beautiful paintings that he did for us of the Faculty of Horror. So Andrew and I actually have that. We each took one. So it's like a artful friendship bracelet.
That's right. And he was very clever with the paintings in that he made 2 of them so that Alex and I wouldn't fight over it. But the same is not true for this Toblerone in this gift basket. I think we both commented as soon as we saw it. And it's a little one, too. So, and now it's disappeared into Alex's shirt because she thinks I won't go after it in there. And she's wrong. And by the way, the nickname, the Demon Owen Garth, the Roomwork podcast referred to him as the Demon of Des Moines. And so we did not ascribe him with that title, but he is a demon of love and caring and generosity and thoughtfulness. And thank you so much, Owen.
And speaking of gifts,
get that out of your shirt. It's melting.
Speaking of gifts, I think one of the most important parts of the holidays, and, you know, especially Christmas as you're growing up, is the gifts. You know, you're so excited to get all these presents. And, you know, you spend a while thinking about, what do I want to ask Santa for? Or rather, what do I want to ask my parents for? And how am I going to get that? And I want it, and I want to play with it. And you OD on this rapturous consumerism on the morning of the 25th, and the rest of the year is downhill until about November 1st. One of the most exciting memories from childhood, which now as we get older, it just starts to get more and more fucking creepy, is Santa Claus.
In order to keep track of all the naughty and nice people, Santa probably spies on you more than the NSA. Write a mean text? Santa's read it. Post a mean comment? Santa's logged it. Of course, he can't do it all by himself. Theory suggests Santa runs naughty nice algorithms with more computing power than Google. That's why he lives in the North Pole, to keep all of his servers cool.
Now, my household wasn't big on Santa Claus. My parents weren't much for whimsy, so they didn't go too far with the Santa Claus myth. I was also the youngest of 3, and I was a fair bit younger than my 2 older sisters. So looking back at photos, there's a lot of photos of my sisters with the mall Santa Claus. And, you know, we'd go to the mall, and you'd be there, and you'd be doing your shopping, and you'd get your photo taken on his lap, and it's kind of creepy in retrospect. I don't have a whole lot of those.
And I'm a bit of the opposite, because I'm my parents' only child. I have some half-siblings, and they are quite a bit older than me. But Christmas was always, I think, a big deal for me and my parents, because we're a little trio. And I remember actually cluing into the whole Santa Claus thing. I felt like pretty early on, like 5 or 6. And then for the couple of years that, you know, I eked it out, and I kind of knew it was because, you know, especially my mom really liked doing that. So I'd be like, yeah, I know, Santa Claus is coming. I think I heard reindeer. And I remember becoming a little sadistic in the last few years, because, you know, when you're supposed to leave milk and cookies out for Santa, I would insist on, like, buying fancy cookies and getting, like, a pile of them and, you know, leaving them out and just making sure there was so much of it, and just saying to my parents before I would go to bed, just being like, guys, I'll know Santa loves me if he eats all of these. So I was, like, force-feeding my parents. I don't know why. They're really great people.
But they went along with it. They bought the fancy stuff. I guess they knew they'd be eating it, right? Because listeners, you know, right? Spoiler alert. There's no Santa Claus. I hope I didn't ruin Christmas for everyone. But yeah, we're actually going to get into the nature of this big cultural lie of Santa Claus. And there's quite a bit of controversy about whether or not it's healthy to indoctrinate our children with this myth.
But even with his team of flying reindeer, how does Santa get around the world in a single night? I mean, there's only so many hours in a day. Well, luckily, he's got more than 24 of them. If Santa starts delivering presents at, say, 10 p.m. at the International Dateline and travels west with the rotating Earth, he can circle the globe without losing any time. Then he can reverse course until kids wake up around 6 a.m., giving him 32 hours total to deliver presents.
So Santa Claus didn't start as how we know him. He started as a much older, more Christian figure than we tend to think of him now. Basically, in pre-Christian times, a lot of the heathens, winter is kind of a freaky time. It's cold, it's dark, your resources are dwindling. So a lot of the folklore and mythology that kind of came out of Europe in that time really had to do with preventative measures and rituals about ghosts and demons and witches and how to kind of avoid being hurt or harmed over the winter solstice. The early notions of Santa Claus began with a figure known as Saint Nicholas, and he was one of the early saints in Christian mythology. And he became known as a really good man. You know, one of the reasons we have stockings today is because he threw coins through a window to save a girl who was about to be, like, sold into, like, sex or something.
I read that too. I read about how he was such a great man because he gave these women money so that they could have a dowry and thus not have to resort to prostitution. This is what greatness for men entailed back in the 4th century, is he could save a woman by giving her virtue some monetary value. I thought that was pretty hilarious, but don't mind me. Carry on.
So the story I heard was that when St. Nicholas threw the coin through a window, it actually landed in this girl's stocking. So over the next few years, word of this spread, and then children began to hang stockings around their house in hopes that St. Nicholas would throw coins and they would go into a stocking and then they wouldn't be whores.
Sticking coins in a stocking actually sounds to me like the way you would pay a whore.
You know, you could pay me. That's one way to maybe break the ice.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I assume cash is acceptable.
Cash works for me, yeah.
So, St. Nicholas died. The date I have is December 6, 343 AD. And after he was canonized, it became St. Nicholas Day. And then as Christianity spread through Europe over the coming centuries, the pagan traditions like the tree and all of the other things that make up our current Christmas climate merged with the holy day of December 25th and the Holy Spirit and all of that, you know, really great Christian stuff. But there was also this underlying fear that December 25th is such a holy day and such an important day in Christianity that the evil forces and the demons and the goblins were really plotting their attack around that time. So there were still those fears. And I think that's what really kind of helped solidify those ritual things of putting out stockings. And in each country, especially in Europe, there was such a wide variation of different practices and different traditions that it's really fascinating to go and look at them.
This episode is by no means going to be a comprehensive account of the legend of Santa Claus. Like, I was just scratching the surface when I was doing my research because there's tons of it out there. And all these legends and cultures kind of came together to make this ether of Santa Claus that we know today. Now, the films that we're going to talk about today both deal with these myths in really interesting ways and in really decidedly non-Western ways.
Yeah, I think because Santa Claus, from the early 20th century, has really represented a lot of our consumerist ideals. And it makes a lot of sense that he became a really prominent figure in North America and throughout the Western world because, you know, we're all God-loving, God-fearing Christians. And, you know, what other better way to celebrate than to spend money, drive the economy forward, and create this excitement for children around consuming and being given gifts and wanting and desiring product.
The idea of children being good and deserving gifts at Christmas has gone largely out the window. I find the bulk of Christmas shopping that I do is partially out of love, but there's also a lot of obligation that it's expected. Everybody's getting gifts. You are probably going to have to get at least one gift for someone you don't even particularly like. It's a very commercial and consumerist thing. In fact, I can think back to when Santa Claus was on Coca-Cola commercials. People started theorizing that Coca-Cola invented Santa Claus because he was wearing the same colors.
And that, I think, is a widely held belief still to this day, but certainly as far as I can trace back, obviously he developed as Sinterklaas in the Netherlands, and then when the Dutch started emigrating to the New World or America, then it became Santa Claus. He became the icon that he is in the poem "'Twas a Night Before Christmas." And then, you know, from there in that description in the poem, he became the jolly red suit wearing guy that we know today.
Now they want to politically correct up Christmas stories so they don't offend nobody and everybody everywhere can enjoy them. So this is a story formerly known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. It is now called 'Twas the Night Before a Non-Denominational Winter Holiday.
I actually just found out that that poem is entitled A Visit from St. Nicholas.
And I think after this episode, you'll all agree that the last person you want coming to visit you is St. Nicholas. The first film we're going to be talking about today is 2010's Saint, or Sint, or St. Nick, whichever one you like, depending on what region you're in, directed by the one and only Dick Maas.
Nou, ik zie jullie morgen, tenminste, als jullie er dan nog zijn.
Doei! Wat bedoelt ze met als jullie er dan nog zijn?
Het is vanavond volle maan.
Het komt maar eens in de 32 jaar voor dat volle maan op 5 december valt.
Ja, nou, volgens de legende komt Sinterklaas je halen als het volle maan is op 5 december.
Hey, pas je wel op voor wie je vanavond de deur open doet? Voor je het weet is het een slecht heilig man.
Hey. Oh, ik schrok me dood.
Zijn je ouders thuis?
Hoezo?
Nou, kun je me vast een cadeautje geven?
Ik ben bang. Timmy, Sinterklaas bestaat niet. Dat heb ik je al 100 keer uitgelegd.
We moeten wat doen als politie. Wij zijn er om de burgers te beschermen.
Verbod op alle Sinterklaasactiviteiten.
Iedereen denkt dat hij jarig is, maar hij is gestorven op 5 december. Hij is gruwelijk vermoord en nu komt hij terug om wraak te nemen.
Pakjesavond is leuk, maar je krijgt altijd zoveel rommel die je niet nodig hebt.
We gaan er allemaal aan!
Sinterklaas kapoentje. Gooi wat in mijn schoentje. Gooi wat in mijn laarsje.
Ik had me toch een hele andere Sinterklaasavond voorgesteld.
This film begins with two prologues. You have one in the medieval, you know, Middle Ages, where the real-life St. Nicholas is terrorizing a town in the Netherlands. And finally, the villagers have had enough, and they band together, and they blow him up in his ship. And then you have another kind of prologue in the 60s, where a young boy is with his family on the eve of St. Nicholas Day, so December 5th, and it's a full moon, and at that moment, the zombified corpse of St. Nick and his evil elves brutally murder his entire family. He escapes, and then we flash forward 32 years to present day-ish, and it is suddenly December 5th again, and it is a full moon. So the young boy has survived, he's fully grown, and he's a detective on the force. He's been keeping a file going of St. Nick, and he knows that since this December 5th has a full moon, he will return and will destroy the city of Amsterdam. From there on in, you have a group of, I think they're teens? They're a little worse for wear. It's hard living out there in Amsterdam, I guess. And they are kind of picked off a bit in this almost slasher kind of style for the first half of the film by St. Nick. So finally, this teen guy and the detective actually team up in a kind of Lethal Weapon style. They work together, fight through the night, come into many battles with St. Nicholas and his elves. And then they finally actually manage to drive St. Nicholas back to his boat and blow him up. and everything kind of goes back to normal. The guy winds up having sex in a bed with this really cute girl until the camera does a crazy pan and we see that Saint Nick is ever watching and always zombified.
Right. That's a pretty good synopsis. This movie is actually bizarre as hell. I didn't know what to expect going into it, but when I was checking it out and you see the image of the poster and you see a heavily stylized, zombified Saint Nick, it almost looks like the cover of Dead Snow, except he's wearing bishop's garb. You know, he's got the hat and whatever that staff is called.
Crozier.
Like Alex said, because it's looking at these teenagers, there's the young Frank, and then there's these two girls named Sophie and Lisa, and Sophie was dating Frank, but Sophie dumps him in front of the whole class in a holiday poem, so Frank is pissed off, and then it turns out that Lisa has been sneaking around behind Sophie's back with him, but then now that Sophie's out of the picture, Lisa doesn't really want to be with Frank, so there's actually quite a bit of interpersonal drama, and instantly, these teenagers aren't especially likable. Right away, I got a bit of a Halloween flavor from it because there is a scene where Lisa and Sophie are walking down the street and being like, ah, I have sex and you don't, and I'm babysitting tonight, and what are you doing, and blah, blah, blah. And then they go their separate ways, and that's when all this deceit kind of comes up. So on the one hand, it humanizes the teenagers, but on the other hand, I really didn't see it coming. This film throws a lot of twists and turns at you right from the very onset, so you're not really sure what you're watching.
I definitely agree, especially that scene from Halloween where, you know, the girls are walking down the street. It was so reminiscent of the scene in this film. But I think Saint also has tinges of John Carpenter's other film, The Fog. It also, especially in the action and the gore sequences, reminded me a lot of Peter Jackson's early work, like Dead Alive. And I think, as we've already touched on, it has so many slasher tropes in it, from the gruesome kills to the teenage silliness. Dick Moss really had a lot of, I think, Americanized influence in making this film, although he did put the veneer of Sinterklaas and all of those other, you know, Scandinavian folklore influences.
That's right. He actually laid that on pretty heavy because at one point I was like, what the fuck is up with all of these poems? You know, they're reading poems while they're exchanging gifts at the front of the class, and then all Lisa can't come out tonight because she has to finish her poems. So that was really heavily steeped in Amsterdam / Dutch St. Nicholas culture, where you don't just give gifts, you also have to come up with a poem. And I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Well, I actually thought, thinking about the setting and the time of this film, is that it has less to do with a condemnation of consumerism or something like that. And I think the American horror films that deal in Christmas, obviously we've already talked about Black Christmas, and then there are things like Silent Night, Deadly Night, Christmas Evil, things like that, which have a more straightforward slasher quality to them. Now, where I think Saint actually does differ from those films and the American tradition of the slasher horror films is not only the really intense supernatural aspect, but also the fact that I think it's more a condemnation of the clerical and Christian institute. Because at one point, they kind of do it almost offhand, I felt, in this film. But there's one point where I believe Frank is getting really angry, and he's saying that Sinterklaas has always been, you know, a fraud because he was always evil and he was not this saintly man. It was just that the Catholic Church had this bishop and he was evil and they were just trying to cover it up.
That's right. I think it was the cop who, pardon my pronunciation, but his name is Gort?
Gort.
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 Yeah, that's exactly right. In addition to the fact that he knows Saint Nick to be a murderous supernatural being who wiped out his entire family 30 years ago, he definitely condemns the holiday for its consumerism. And so does Sophie at one point. Sophie is at home with her little brother. She's stuck babysitting. And she's talking to Lisa. And Lisa's like, ah, fuck, I've got to give gifts tonight. And I've got to do these poems. And Sophie's like, ah, not me. I'm going to watch TV and smoke cigarettes. And at one point, she has a discussion with her brother about it. And her brother says, you know, how come we don't exchange gifts? Like, wasn't I good last year? And Sophie's like, well, we don't do that because it's stupid. And the kid's disappointed. It was almost astonishing to see such a glib and straight-faced rejection of the consumerist element of the holidays. We certainly don't see that here in the West. Western movies about Christmas, but there are a lot of people around here who do not celebrate Christmas for that very reason.
So this Saint Nicholas, he's like our Santa Claus, yeah?
Yeah, you can say that. Send a black guy. They're his helpers. They throw the presents into the chimney. But when children are naughty, they put them in a bag and take them to Spain.
What do they do with them then?
You don't want to know.
Sounds like a bunch of bloody pedophiles to me.
Yeah, they should be arrested. Follow me. We're going to see Amsterdam's most famous nightclub now, the Banana Bar.
So the film, it's kind of fun. The CGI is pretty heavy-handed and maybe a bit unnecessary. The violence is really inventive and schlocky, and I can definitely see the Peter Jackson influence that you just mentioned. A lot of people getting, you know, impaled through the head and it coming out their mouth when you least expect and stuff like that. And it's also pretty dark. I've got to add that the narrative is unconventional in that basically what happens is this Saint Nick, in addition to killing anyone who comes in his way, is abducting children and putting them on the boat. And so when I found out that their plan was to straight up blow up the boat and fuck all these kids who are trapped in it, I was kind of like, really? No, they're not just going to really? And they did.
Well, I love that, you know, in the days or so after Frank wakes up in the hospital and, you know, they show the newscasts of how it's all being covered up. And they basically say that it was such a wonderful St. Nicholas Day, and unfortunately, like, this orphanage burned down, and this ship blew up, and some people got murdered, and this detective was actually a mass killer. They have this way of covering it up, and I think it's a very interesting and very dark commentary on the lengths that some people will go to still maintain the status quo, and, you know, maybe to reduce panic, but also to hold their position of power. So I was thinking a lot after watching this movie about the setting, and especially because it really did remind me so much of The Fog and the, you know, importance of St. Nicholas and that his boat comes from Spain on December 5th. And that's what they keep saying in the film, or it's mentioned a few times. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, Spain actually had a big hold on the Netherlands. The Dutch actually fought for independence in something called the 80 Years' War, so that's 80, or the Dutch War of Independence. And that happened from 1568 to 1648. And they actually fought for their autonomy and gained it and have been the lovely pot-smoking people that they are today, and prostitutes.
Yeah, there's a little bit of interesting history embedded in this movie, particularly in the fact that when Frank first encounters St. Nicholas, he is going out with his friends and they are dressed up as St. Nicholas and also as St. Nicholas's sidekick, who is known as Black Peter. These guys are in straight up blackface, like no bullshit blackface. I'm like, but I did some research and this really wasn't a big, I'm not going to say it's not a big deal because it's still hotly contested, but it was common practice for Saint Nick to be depicted with a sidekick who was a Moor. And part of the mythology of them bringing presents from Spain was because historically Amsterdam had some issues with Moors coming from Spain and taking slaves back with them. So that was kind of the child abduction myth that got co-opted into that.
And as the notion of Black Peter kind of became more and more contentious, the Dutch actually tried to say that, oh, he's not really a Moor, it's just soot, because he's going up and down a chimney all day, day. I don't think many people bought that.
No, it's total bullshit. It was just, they took this figure and they wanted to make him the antithesis to Saint Nick, so they just ascribe to him any undesirable trait, because in addition to his complexion, there's also been issues about Black Peter being depicted wearing earrings and having red lips. So a cross-dressing Black Peter? Oh my god.
The perceived problem with Black Pete is the name. He's black. Some pressure groups and activists believe he's a mockery to people of African descent.
Black Pete is one of St. Nicholas's helpers in our present-day folklore. And being a helper of a big man with a white beard, who is also Caucasian-looking, to many people looks like, this could be a remnant of slavery.
Even the UN has been summoned to make a ruling and found the character indeed a racist.
So I think it's interesting when we look at the history of the Dutch and the history of Spain, and that it was this kind of appeasement of the Dutch to, you know, bring them presents and be like, no, we're still cool, it's fine. And actually to take that myth and turn it on its head and actually have it be this really cruel, sinister entity that is not letting go and that is still so vengeful against these people that they still have these sins to attest for, even though they were just defending themselves.
It's true. And we're pulling these critical themes out of it. But I think if you were to watch the movie, it's mostly just all in good fun. CGI, great gore, some silly, silly sex scenes.
It can't be comfortable doing it on a hospital bed.
Well, it's just this really shitty romance because the onset of their relationship was Lisa being like, you know what? This isn't as much fun when we're not sneaking around my best friend's back. Then her best friend gets killed, and then she's kind of like, oh, maybe I kind of like him. But Frank gets pinned for the murders of his Black Peter friends. I don't know if we mentioned that in the synopsis, but when they are initially attacked, Frank survives, and he gets picked up by the cops, and he gets pinned for these murders. But then by the end of the movie, he's the hero because part of the spin of the media of making St. Nicholas Day a very successful holiday was that, you know, Frank saved the day and he, I forget how, but basically now Lisa wants him again and we're supposed to be so happy they're together because they're clearly so in love.
Ow!
Well, I think that's the thing about this film. There's so many elements to it. There are so many, and some of them work well, but I don't think any of them are truly successful. But it's still a really fun, dark look at the holiday season. And if you're still looking for some kind of weird, fucked up movie to watch in the midst of all this holiday cheer, I think you could do a lot worse than Saint.
That's true, but you could do a lot better too, and we're going to move on shortly. But one other thing I wanted to point out about this film when I was doing my research was the poster for this film. Now, the poster for me, I already mentioned that looking upon it, I was just kind of like, okay, the film is about this. You know, the poster told me everything I needed to know. But the poster at the time got some controversy because it was showing this very evil depiction of Saint Nick. And insofar as the film was rated R or whatever, kids walking by could see it. And so people actually took Mr. Dick Moss to task, criticizing this poster. You know, it's frightening our children. They're going to think that this is what Saint Nicholas is. Whereas he countered back with, well, if you're able to convince your kids that Saint Nick exists in the first place, then surely you can convince them that this poster isn't the real Saint Nicholas. And he won, and the case got thrown out. So, score one for Dick Moss. So moving along to our second film of the episode, I'm sure you've heard of this one. This one has become the quintessential horror Christmas movie for a variety of reasons we're going to get into. And this is also made in 2010, Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale.
We finally found something else than just plain rocks and dirt.
This mountain is like a giant icebox.
A storing what?
We are standing on the biggest burial mound in the world.
I know how that do it.
Hyvää joulua.
Minkälaiset sudet tekee tämmöstä jälkeen?
Isot ja vittumaiset.
Santa Claus.
What is that? Where is Mr. Green?
Selitä sille, että meillä on täällä pukki myytävänä.
Santa is going to find out who is naughty or nice.
Now, when I say that this one is a really quintessential horror Christmas movie, it's because it deals with the mythology of Krampus, but it also deals with the origin story of Santa Claus. And this movie, insofar as it's very much a horror movie, it's quite gory in some respects. It also has many elements of fantasy, and it feels like a fairy tale. It's told from the point of view of a young boy. The score is very Danny Elfman inspired, and so it has this really ethereal quality, but at the same time, it's got a grit to it. It takes place in the mountains of Finland, and everything has this grit to it. A lot of films that take place in snowy environments have this beautiful snow. Like, in fact, even in Sint, there's always big snowy flakes falling really slowly, and they're very picturesque and lovely. Whereas in Rare Exports, it's a very gritty environment where everybody's wearing these sweaters that are dirty and torn and long underwear, and the environment looks really harsh and cruel alongside this very touching and moving story. Now, the story, as I said, is told from the point of view of a young boy named Petri. And we're not given his age, but I'm going to estimate him at about 10. I think he's about 10 years old. Anyway, Petri has one friend in the world because he's living in this remote mountain town. And he and his friend live in a reindeer herding community up in the mountains. And the reindeer herders are fucked over by a mountain blasting expedition happening nearby that kills all the reindeer. So the community is really upset about it because that's their food and their income for the year. And they discover that Petri and his friend have been watching the excavation. And Petri has discovered that they have unearthed Santa Claus. And he has this conversation with his friend where, first of all, he discovers that Santa Claus isn't real. Like, oh, what? You didn't know it was your dad giving you the gifts? And that's our neighbor who dresses up in the suit. And he's just kind of like, oh. And he goes back to his house and he does his own independent study on Santa Claus and discovers the myth of the Krampus, of Santa being a monstrous, vengeful entity that, in addition to gifting the good kids, is just as want to take away the bad kids and do horrible things to them. So he starts wearing armor, he wears a helmet, and he tapes a bunch of cardboard to his butt to protect him from the lashings. And he has this very strained relationship with his father. Pietari's mom is out of the picture, and it's definitely implied that she was lost not that long before, so he's got this very strained relationship with his dad. Now, his dad has set up a bear trap outside of their house, and he winds up catching not a bear, but this oversized, emaciated figure with a long white beard and a red coat. And of course, Petri right away is like, that's Santa Claus, and he's very dangerous. But Petri's dad and his friends find out the hard way that this man is indeed very dangerous. And they discover that these creatures are actually minions gathering children for a huge horned creature that we never get to see. We find out that the minions are stealing ovens and heaters and even hair dryers to defrost this frozen Krampus figure that they've unearthed from the mountain. So as it goes, Petri, who has been misbehaving the entire movie up until this point, and he's always in shit with his dad, everyone's always shitting all over him, but he just takes charge and is like, you know what, I know what's going on here, and he destroys the giant Krampus, and he manages to rehabilitate these elves to behave as Santa does, in a nurturing manner, and taking children on his lap and giving them gifts, and they start exporting them across the world, hence the title Rare Exports. It's these Santas being shipped out in crates. And in so doing, Petri becomes a man, and his father learns to express his love for him, and it's this lovely fairy tale where, in the end, everything is good and wonderful, and so that's where Santa came from.
I have to say, I think this is one of my favorite horror movies in the last 10 years. I've seen it a few times now, and each time I see it, it really speaks to me in the creepiness of it, but also the emotional punch. And I think what this film does that is so unique in films that have come out in the last 10, 15 years especially, is that it has an inherent goodness to it. There are good characters. Every character, you know, outside of maybe the evil American businessman and the evil elf minions, this community, it's full of good people who maybe don't always make the best choices, but are making the best choices that they think of at the time. And I think especially in the face of films like Hostel and New French Extremity, which all have their place right now in horror, they truly do, I think that's what makes Rare Exports so unique, is that it really gives you a renewed faith in humanity, and I really love that.
That's right. It's a really beautiful movie that can be enjoyed strictly on its storytelling merits, but also on its aesthetic. As I mentioned, it's got that gritty, outdoorsy feel. Roger Ebert said that it was a Santa Claus origin story crossed with The Thing. And I think that that was actually very apt, in that there isn't a whole lot of gore, but what horror there is because you feel so strongly for these characters and this community, and as Alex just said, every character is understandable, even in their shortcomings and foibles, that you really care about what's going on, especially poor Pietri. This boy is so lonely. He's got one friend in the world who lives in his community who's a little bit older than him and so has the luxury of badgering him for being immature. And looking more closely at the film, you see some really interesting discourse about masculinity and manhood. There isn't a single female in this film, but patriarchy is still challenged through masculinity. Pietri's dad is clearly still grieving. He's choked up, especially around Christmas time. He tries to cook something and fucks it up, and the whole family is eating gingerbread cookies. Pietri, trying to break through to his dad, is, like I said, always in trouble, always grounded, always told to stay inside and stay back. And so the message here is that manhood, or even adulthood more generally, is in conviction, in leadership. And I really liked the way it tackled that.
Yeah, and I think especially, I don't know, Andrew, if you've seen it this year, but Kirk Cameron, that awful human being who thinks he's like the best Christian in the world, has really come out to really try to save Christmas with this awful new movie he has out right now. And he had a whole YouTube video about how a woman's place is in the kitchen, and, you know, it's her responsibility to make Christmas for the family, and that's where her joy comes from. And it's such bullshit.
Let your children, your family, see your joy in the way that you decorate your home this Christmas, in the food that you cook, the songs you sing, the stories you tell, and the traditions that you keep. Invite your whole neighborhood into your Christmas, and invite the world into our story of our King and His kingdom. Join me and go see Saving Christmas, November 14th.
But I think Andrea is absolutely right in this, in that, you know, as much as we talk about feminism on this podcast, and for anyone who knows us and knows anything about the world knows that feminism is about equality. And I think what we see in this group of men is these men initially struggling to connect with each other, but once they bond together, those bonds run deep and they care about each other. And the final moments of the film when Pietri and his father are really able to come together as a parent and a child are so lovely and so profound. And it just, gosh, if that doesn't fill you with the Christmas or holiday spirit, nothing will.
There's also a very, very moving moment in the film that, if you haven't seen it, I don't want to spoil it, but at the same time, you really shouldn't be listening to this episode if you haven't seen the films. But Alex was texting me that she had just watched Rare Exports, and she was like, I cried my eyes out. You'll know when. And sure enough, there is a part where Pietri is certain that he knows what to do, and he puts himself in a situation where he sacrifices himself for the community. And he just kind of says, yep, I'm not coming back. Tell my dad what I did. And it is beautiful, and your heart just breaks into a million pieces. And of course, he gets out of it okay, and he's even surprised that he gets out of it okay, and goodness and survival is restored.
And I love that in this movie, those moments of understanding, communication, bonding, they come out of like the biggest, craziest action sequences. Like, Pietri is about to be run down by evil elves, and it's cutting between that and his father and his buddy about to blow up with a huge Krampus demon. It's insane, and it's so imaginative and wonderful and totally stirring. It's almost diehard level of action. It's so wonderful to watch.
So I mentioned that this film is a rare example of a film that deals with Krampus. It's interesting that the film never actually utters the word Krampus. It's just like, this is the real Santa. But when you see this enormous being, he's encased in ice, and all you can really make out is these two giant goat-like horns coming out of the ice, which I actually thought it was hilarious, because these guys are reindeer herders, right? So before they blow the motherfucker up, they're like, no, we're taking a trophy, and they take a saw, and they take those fucking horns with them, because that is badass. I thought that was so cool. But what's interesting about the Krampus figure is he's kind of analogous to Black Peter, just to a different part of Europe. The Krampus was a figure who would accompany Saint Nick from house to house, and the good children would be treated with gifts from Saint Nick, and the bad children would be stuck in Krampus's sack. So the two of them were the yin and yang of the Christmas spirit. You know, there was the reward for goodness, and there was also the threat of the Krampus. But they really served to work together. It's never a one or the other type thing. Now, in recent years, Krampus has obviously been adopted by horror fans as, you know, we're going to take the yang in this situation because he's scary, he's badass looking, he's goaty, he's with his cloven hooves. He kind of looks like the devil, but then he also has certain traits that he shares with Black Peter as well.
So as I was mentioning in the film Saint and how that had to do with a more clerical Christian commentary, I feel like Rare Exports actually tackles the notion of consumerism and capitalism in a really interesting way and in an unexpected way. So you have these miners who are blowing up this mountain, and unbeknownst to them or kind of known to them, they are uncovering Krampus or the original Santa Claus. Now, at the same time, you're dealing with the storyline of this reindeer herding community losing their entire livelihood for the year. And I also love that we in North America especially really think of reindeer as leading Santa's way. And in Finland, those fuckers get eaten. And if you get lost in the woods or the forest or the snow, you usually got some reindeer beef jerky on you. So you can snack on that to keep you going for a little while. And so in this idea of this community losing their livelihood for the year, they actually subvert the initial trauma that they have so that by the end of it, they have this whole new livestock of evil elves who they're going to train to be good and sell them at an exorbitant rate and really reinvest and reinvent their community. And in doing so, they actually manage to sell back our holiday expectations to us on their own terms, which I think is incredibly interesting.
It's a really great point of how industrious these people are. And not only do they learn the meaning of Christmas in a really cheesy way, they manage to subvert the mythology, like you just said. I find the mythology of Santa Claus just to be so interesting, especially with regard to this whole Kirk Cameron campaign to bring the Christ back into Christmas and remove the X and don't say Happy Holidays. It's Merry Christmas, for doggone sakes. It's hilarious to me because part of the myth of Santa Claus is a secularization of Saint Nick as a result of the Reformation, as they wanted to take the saints out of the picture and remove the religious aspect for cultural, important, and good reasons. So the fact that there's a backlash and a desire to return to that is really interesting to me.
Yeah, there was a Fox newscaster, I think maybe last year or the year before, where they were bitching and moaning on Fox News about, you know, how we have to save Christmas and they don't want to say Happy Holidays anymore, just like Kirk Cameron. And this one news anchor was going on and on about how she had to get in a car, drive around with her kids to find a nativity scene to show them. And the whole time, and this has been made fun of, I think, on like The Daily Show and John Oliver, and I think they've really gone after them, appropriately so. And, you know, you think about it and it's like, really? That's what you're doing with your kids around Christmas. You're throwing them in a car and making them look at wooden figure and driving around to look at wooden figurines of people that I don't know if they existed. And rather than just living with each other, spending time and creating memories, you're creating memories of driving around in a cold minivan looking for wooden statues, which I think is almost more horrifying than any Krampus or anything like that.
You know, what the law says now is that if you put a Christian display, then you have to put a Satanistic display or something. In Tallahassee, Florida, in the Capitol, they have a Satan display right next to the Christmas tree. And I bet
we
you
have
most
enough
of
displays
like
of Satan
that.
Going on around the world. I think that a lot of people have decided that this is pretty silly season stuff. And I do think the tide is turning in this whole discussion.
We won it. We won the
Christmas.
War. And,
I really
and
do.
You know, I have to confess, you know what I do? I'm like a guerrilla fighter in a war on Christmas. Mm-hmm. You know what I do? I put little shepherds right in front of City Hall in my town.
You sneak out at night.
Yeah, I sneak out at night.
Like,
I put the
like
little,
the elf on the shelf, Bill O'Reilly,
the little
going
thing.
Around, putting
right.
his little...
Or if I know that there's a secular person in my town or the town neighboring me, I'll put a little baby Jesus on their windshield.
I'm going to come over it.
It's true. It's actually a weird contradiction of Christianity that's like, oh, this shouldn't be about Santa Claus. It should be about Jesus. But what is Santa Claus but an act of faith, right? Is it just something you want to believe in because it makes you happy and it enriches your life? And, you know, that's why we do it, right? I think everyone has considered whether or not it's actually right to feed children this lie because you know they're just going to grow up and realize the truth. And I've read arguments that it stunts critical thought in children because it encourages them to just, mommy and daddy say so don't think for yourselves until you're a little bit older and then you're like, but wasn't that fun? And you're like, no, fuck no, I was deceived. It's not a parental lie, it's a cultural lie. And I think that's a really interesting distinction because we're told a lot of cultural lies, and I think that actually really strengthens critical thinking in our children.
What I think is really interesting about rare exports is that, as Andrea mentioned, Pietri initially believes in Santa Claus, and he's shocked to find out that, as his friend tells him, Santa Claus isn't real, and it's, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And what I loved about it was that Pietri was the first person to believe what he saw and then actually do the research on it. Like, it was a total Buffy moment where it was a montage of him hitting the books mm-hmm. and going back and researching it. And he was the first one to believe, the first one to protect himself and his friends as best he could, and the first one to always pipe up in any situation that, no, it's Santa and Santa's evil, or there's someone after us, or there's something happening. And it does take the adults a while to believe. And I love, you know, a lot of the scenes that Andrea was referring to, where initially you see it as his dad is butchering animals and Pietri doesn't want to go into the butchering shed. And there's this protective bubble around him. And then when the evil Santa elf thing is caught in the trap, the father's trying to keep him away from it and sends him to the house. And it's only when Pietri gets a bit too close that the Santa actually wakes up and he's not dead. And he's trying to go for Pietri and trying to attack him or grab him or something. And I love that notion of the inherent innocence of a child and that willingness to believe, the willingness to go that extra mile in their own imagination or their own mind and not have those blocks up. I think that's such a big part of this movie, and I think it explores it so brilliantly.
Now, we should mention that Rare Exports is actually a feature film. It was written and directed by Jalmari Helander, who had made a short in 2003 called Rare Exports Inc., which can be found on YouTube. And Alex and I both highly recommend both it and a sequel that came up a little bit later called Rare Exports Official Safety Instructions.
Just before the first snow of winter falls, they begin their work. Professional hunters with astonishing skills, refined throughout the centuries, passed down from father to son.
They're very cute and charming, and you can see the seeds of the movie, but some movies that are based upon shorts expand upon them and over-explain them in the wrong way, but just like The Babadook, Rare Exports does it so well.
Yeah, it felt like there is a really natural progression watching those shorts and then seeing the evolution of it. They were done as these kind of cute commercials with a really dark, twisted humor thrown in at like these specific moments. And I love that in the film, they went away from that until the very end. And in the majority of the film, they're just really in the lives of these characters and they're exploring what happens when you're remote and you have to deal with these things and you have to blow up a huge Krampus and your child might sacrifice himself and he might be the most adorable child ever. And I might have cried through that whole thing. But it is so wonderful to see a director like Helander who is willing to take risks. And I just really have to talk about how beautifully this film is shot. I agree, like Andrea mentioned, I think Saint was actually a generally well-shot movie. I think there was a lot of inventiveness for it, a little too much CGI. But Rare Exports is just, it's the most beautiful movie. And I actually, the first time I saw it was on the big screen. And it was absolutely stunning. And it still holds up on a smaller screen. And it's lovely to see a horror fantasy creepy, lovely little movie that has those production values. It makes such a difference.
So that's it for us for this special holiday edition of the Faculty of Horror. I always think of last year, I was working on editing the Faculty of Horror on my way to Ottawa from Ottawa. And so I was going home to visit my family and I was hoping to work on it on the train, but the train was kind of bumpy and I was in first class and I got a little bit tipsy.
Oh,
so I didn't get to work on it. So it was actually Christmas Eve. I'm up late by myself. My parents are asleep. Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse, except me and my headphones working on the podcast. So there's really nothing I'd rather be doing on the holidays than spending it with you, our wonderful listeners.
I think as you get older, as we mentioned before, it's such a wonderful time of year because you make the time to spend it with the people you care about. And I care about you guys, and I care about Andrea. And it's so wonderful to get to share a little bit of your time, which I know is really busy. And whether you're traveling home, you're home, you're hanging out with friends, we just hope you have the most wonderful holiday season. And let us know, what are your other favorite horror holiday movies to watch? There are so many great ones, and we always love suggestions, so do let us know.
Now is a very good time to be writing into us because, if you didn't know, our next episode, our January episode every year, I guess I can say that conclusively now that we've been running for 2 years, next episode is our assessment episode where we go through mail that we've gotten from you that we haven't necessarily addressed on the website or that we'd like to address in more detail. So if you have anything to say about this episode or about any of our episodes, we strongly urge you to get at us. You can do so on our website at facultyofhorror.com. You can email us at info@facultyofhorror.com. And we're still having a contest. So if you ever felt the urge to give us a rating on iTunes, now is a really good time because we are giving away 2 copies of Horror Movie Heroes, Rue Morgue's latest installment in their library series. It is full of interviews with horror movie legends and heavyweights. There's an amazing piece on Joss Whedon in there. You've got John Carpenter, Vampira, everyone's in there. So we're really excited to give that away. We're going to sign them for you, and we're going to be announcing the winners at our next episode. So stay tuned for that.
And just a little teaser for you guys. We are actually growing a little bit. Not too much. Nothing's going to change. But we have a very exciting prospect on the horizon. We're going to move. We're going to grow. We're going to be the same Faculty of Horror you love/like. And we're going to be there. And so there's lots of great stuff happening on our end. And we are just excited because it's only going to make the podcast better. We're going to have more resources. And I think it's just going to make it a better experience for all of us because we're all in it together. So from me and Andrea, a very scary Krampus and a happy new year to each and every one of you. But for now, office hours are closed.
Oh, Santa, I've been waiting on you.
That's funny, kid, because I've been coming for you.
Oh, Santa, I've been killing just for fun.
Well, the party's over, kid, because I got a bullet in my gun.
A bullet in your what?
Life is hard, but look at me, I turned out all right.
Hey Santa, why don't we talk about it, work it out?
Believe me, this ain't what I wanted. I love all you kids, you know that. Hell, I remember when you were just 10 years old, playing out there in the desert, just waiting for a sip of that sweet Mojave rain.
In the sweet Mojave rain, the boy was on his own.
Don't shoot me, Santa Claus, I've been a clean living boy, I promise you. Did every little thing you asked me to, and I can't believe the things I'm going through. Hey, Santa Claus, no one else around believes me. Well, the children on the block, they tease me, and I couldn't let them off that easy. They had it coming, so why can't you see? I couldn't turn my cheek no longer. The sun is gone.